that they are most unlikely to be natural. The largest of these lies at a depth of between 21.3 and 27.4 meters, 70 to 90 feet, and measures approximately 5.5 meters, 18 feet high, 13.7 meters, 45 feet long, and 9.1 meters, 30 feet wide. On our visit to Gunung Padang in early June 2014, excavations were still being held up by objections from archaeologists, but by August, following a decisive intervention by Indonesia's then President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, Danny and his team were finally able to proceed for a first short season. Unfortunately, however, the work was halted very soon afterwards in October 2014, when President Yudhoyono completed his second term of office and stepped down. His successor, President Joko Widodo, has thus far not shown the same level of interest in and enthusiasm for the project, perhaps because of objections from Bandung Archaeological Center Chief Desriel Shanti, who launched a public attack on the Gunung Padang excavations in late September 2014, complaining that they did not follow the standard methods that are usually applied to archaeological projects. "I've yet to go to the site," she said, "but I can judge it from photographs. An archaeological excavation method shouldn't be carried out in that way." She also objected that funding had been allocated to the work. This funding, she felt, should have gone to her own department. At the beginning of October 2014, as the reader will recall from Chapter 2, Danny had written to me enthusiastically as follows: "The research progress has been great. We have excavated three more spots right on top of the megalithic site in the past couple of weeks, which give more evidence and details about the buried structures. We have uncovered lots more stone artifacts from the excavations. The existence of the pyramid-like structure beneath the megalithic site is now loud and clear. Even for non-specialists, it is not too difficult to understand if they come and see for themselves. We have found some kind of open hall, buried by soil 5 to 7 meters thick. However, we have not yet got into the main chamber. We are now drilling to the suspected location of the chamber, based on subsurface geophysic, in the middle of the megalithic site." It was only a few days after Danny sent me that mail that the presidency changed hands, and the drilling and excavations were stopped. Nonetheless, the first short, interrupted season did produce important results. As Danny confirmed in his correspondence with me, even the relatively young lair that was all they had time to excavate, the second artificial columnar rock lair beneath the megalithic site visible on the surface, yielded a radiocarbon date of 5,200 BC, in other words, 7,200 years ago, nearly 3,000 years older than the orthodox dating for the pyramids of Giza in Egypt, and there are firm indications from the original remote sensing and core drilling work of much older layers below. In short, it is now evident to all that Gunung Padang is vastly older than the 3,000 years that archaeologists had insisted upon for decades. Even the most hostile amongst them, therefore, have begun to reframe their assessment of the site and to refer to it as a gigantic terraced tomb, which was part of the biggest megalithic culture in the archipelago. I stayed in touch with Danny during the writing of this book. On the 14th of January 2015, he emailed me to tell me the disappointing news that further fieldwork had not yet been authorized. "We are still waiting for the new government to take action on the continuity of the national team for Gunung Padang," he wrote. He was concerned, he added, about construction activities that had been undertaken at Gunung Padang in the interim by Public Works, Tourism Department and others. "They are conducted without a clear plan, design and consultation with us, so they are destroying the site." He remained optimistic, however, that he and his team would be allowed to continue with their excavations shortly. "If so," he said, "by the end of 2015, I hope to know more about the second layer, the 7,000 years old constructions, and begin to understand about the third layer, pre-10,000 years ago." On the 10th of March 2015, I heard from Danny again. Most unfortunately, he could only report that there had been no progress at all since his mail of the 14th of January. "The new Ministry of Culture has not activated the national team yet. We are still waiting and hoping the new ministry will have a good attitude toward Gunung Padang research." Time will tell. But the auspices do not look good, and as Magicians of the Gods goes to press, I fear that the dead hand of orthodox archaeology may once again have prevailed, in what almost appears to be a deliberate strategy to prevent us from learning the truth about our past. Below the layers, dated to approximately 7,000 and 10,000 years ago, are the even older strata of man-made constructions at Gunung Padang. These strata, as yet unexcavated, as yet unexplored, identified only by core drilling and remote sensing equipment, go back before the cataclysmic episode of the Younger Dryas, 12,800 years ago to 11,600 years ago, and deep into the last ice age, when the lost civilization still thrived. The lost civilization that we know only through myths and traditions, and through the works of its survivors as they sought to recreate the former world of the gods. Indonesia must rank amongst the most plausible candidates anywhere on Earth for the heartland in which that civilization could have evolved and grown to maturity. In recognition of this, a number of serious researchers, including Dani Natawijaja and Professor Aricio Santos, have presented evidence that Plato has been misunderstood over the location of Atlantis in the Atlantic Ocean. All the clues, they say, really point east and place the lost civilization between the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. In other words, on the exact spot once occupied by the flooded Ice Age continent of Sundaland, of which the Indonesian islands are the surviving remnant. Mainstream archaeology remains strongly opposed to the notion of any lost civilization by any name, regardless of whether it is said to be located in the West or in the East. In my opinion, however, there's already enough high strangeness around Indonesia to raise question marks over such thinking. A few examples. I've already mentioned Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, quite possibly a completely different human species from our own, that survived for tens of thousands of years after our other evolutionary cousins, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, had vanished from the Earth. It's intriguing that the date of extinction of Homo floresiensis appears to have been around 12,000 years ago, exactly in the apocalyptic Younger Dryas window. In its issue of the 8th of October 2014, the prestigious academic journal Nature reported in a tone of astonishment that elaborate, sophisticated cave paintings had been found on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi with a minimum age of 39,900 years, making this art as old or older than anything comparable ever found in Europe, previously considered to be the exclusive home of such early advanced symbolic behavior. And it was Nature again, in its issue of the 12th of February 2015, that reported the discovery on Java of geometric engravings generally interpreted as indicative of modern cognition and behavior, yet dated to 500,000 years ago, which is 300,000 years older than the supposed first appearance of anatomically modern humans on our planet. If evidence like this that rewrites the human story has remained undiscovered in Indonesia until so recently, how much else is still to be found, and why shouldn't the next turn of the archaeologist's spade reveal a hitherto unrecognized civilization? Given the vast loss of terrain suffered across this entire region as a result of more than 100 meters of sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age, anything is possible. This is why Gunung Padang is so important, and most important of all, perhaps, is that huge chamber, identified by ground-penetrating radar and other remote sensing technologies, lying deep within the pyramid, between 70 and 90 feet beneath its apex. Is it the Hall of Records of the lost civilization? Once again, only time will tell. Mountains of Fire and Ash. Gunung Padang wasn't quite the end of our June 2014 research trip. After re-exploring that amazing site, absorbing its ancient, mellow, slightly perplexing atmosphere, and understanding again, even more clearly than before, why it is still to this day known as the Mountain of Light by local people who love and revere it, Santa and I travel back to Bandung, the regional capital. From there, the following morning, we catch a train for the 7-hour journey to Yogyakarta in central Java, where we mean to spend a few days around the fabled Buddhist temple of Borobudur. The train journey is charming, and the endless vistas it affords of rice fields and mountains and green trees, everywhere bursting with life, and the friendly, busy people are a delight. It's nightfall by the time we arrive in Yogyakarta, but the next morning we're up at 4 a.m. to drive to Puntuk Setumbu, a hillside looking down into the valley where Borobudur stands. The air is not cold. It's never seriously cold here. But it's fresh, and there's a wide pool of darkness beneath us. Expectant darkness, because that's where Borobudur is, and will soon be lit up by the sun. But the sun rises slowly, light seeping into the sky, gradually illuminating the thickly forested mountainside and the valley below, showing us the distant slopes of the towering twin volcanoes that also overlook Borobudur, Mount Merapi, literally Fire Mountain, which is still active, and Mount Merbabu, Mountain of Ash, which is dormant. By about 5 a.m., the dense trees that carpet the valley floor begin to become visible, though shrouded in low-lying cloud, and soon afterwards a breath of wind stirs the mist, giving us our first glimpse of the massive, jagged, pyramidal form of Borobudur, crowned with a towering stupa that seems to reach for the heavens, a cosmic axis piercing the navel of the earth to connect sky and underworld. As the sun rises higher, the mist swirls and expands, winding and curling amongst the trees, pooling in the deeper parts of the valley. But above it all, Borobudur stands out clear like some mythical island from the dawn of time. We're impatient to visit it after this tantalizing invitation, but we have another plan for today, and drive east out of Yogyakarta, heading first for Surakarta City, usually referred to by its residents as Solo, and then onwards further east to Mount Lawu, another massive dormant volcano. The whole of Java, it seems, is straddled by these slumbering giants, whose outpourings in the past have blessed the island with essential nutrients, making its soils incredibly verdant, fertile, and productive. We wind our way up Lawu's precipitous slopes through green, glittering tea plantations until, at an altitude of 910 meters, 2,990 feet, with the peak of the volcano still towering more than 2,000 meters above us, we reach the little hamlet where Danny Natawijaja has recommended we take a look at Shandisuku, a rather odd and mysterious little temple. It seems out of place in Indonesia, he told us. It looks more like a Mayan step pyramid. This, it turns out, is absolutely correct. Suku, though smaller, is astonishingly similar in general appearance to the step pyramid of Kukulcan Quetzalcoatl at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. Suku was built in the 15th century, just before the conversion of Indonesia from Hinduism and Buddhism to Islam. Why it was built, however, or why its style is so distinctive and unusual for Indonesia, remains a mystery to scholarship. The Kukulcan pyramid, in its present incarnation, though it encloses an older structure, is thought to have been built between the 9th and 12th centuries. Thousands of miles and hundreds of years therefore separate the two structures, and the likelihood of any direct influence of one upon the other is slim. As I explore Suku, however, and it has a mystical air about it, enhanced by a late afternoon mist that wreathes the whole mountainside, I find myself wondering whether the similarities are pure accident, or whether they might not be better explained by the influence in both regions of the same remotely ancient common source. The signal. Certainly, such an influence is present at Borobudur, a pyramid temple consisting of 1.6 million blocks of volcanic andesite, constructed over a period of 50 years from the last quarter of the 8th to the first quarter of the 9th century AD. There is no dedication inscription, indeed almost no inscriptions of any kind. This is, however, undoubtedly a Buddhist monument, a fact of which one could hardly be in any doubt, since its acres of exquisitely beautiful reliefs are devoted for the most part to stories from the life of Buddha. Within Buddhist thought, it is to be regarded as a cosmic mountain, a sacred replica of the universe, designed to lead the pilgrim to the realization of full enlightenment, Sambodhi, by which a bodhisattva becomes a Buddha, the ultimate goal of Buddhism. The devotee follows a path to the top of this mountain, keeping his right shoulder to the monument. Subsequently, his path brings him along the many galleries that show panels with scenes in stone relief of which the Buddhist character has become clear and which have been recognized to represent the ancient Buddhist texts. On this clockwise perambulation of the monument, gradually working your way up from earth to sky, you pass 504 life-sized statues of the Buddha, of which 432 are found on the square stepped terraces, with the remaining 72 on the three circular terraces at the summit surrounding the great central stupa. In addition, calculations of the correct pilgrim route through the four bas-relief galleries have shown that the direction of the path, as well as the number of times that each gallery must be walked, is determined by the bas-reliefs on each side of the gallery walkway. In order to read the entire collection in the correct order, worshippers are compelled to complete a total of 10 circuits around the galleries in the clockwise direction. In so doing, each worshipper passes by a Buddha image an additional 2,160 times before reaching the summit entranceway. The reader will realize immediately, as I did when I undertook my own perambulations of Borobudur, that with these numbers we are back once again in the mysteriously insistent and universal numerical code described in previous chapters. This code, as we've seen, is based on the hard-to-observe phenomenon of the precession of the equinoxes that unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. That sees the equinoctial sun housed in turn by each constellation of the zodiac for 2,160 years, and that is deployed to make the Great Pyramid of Giza a model of our planet on a scale of 1 to 43,200. Its presence also at Baalbek and at Göbekli Tepe, and now here at Borobudur, as well as in myths and traditions from all around the world, can only be explained by a remote common influence manifesting in all these places and forms, that almost unbelievable ancestor civilization, identified by Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend, that first dared to understand the world as created according to number, weight, and measure. It's my intuition, as I've suggested at several points throughout this book, that the lost civilization sought to send a signal to the future, indeed to us, today, in the 21st century, and that the carrier wave of this signal is the precessional code. Two different means were used to ensure the signal's survival through time. First, it was embedded in myths and legends, and in mathematical and architectural precepts that would be passed on and renewed again and again by the different cultures that received them, thus boosting the signal and allowing it to remain intact for thousands of years. Even if those through whose hands and minds the signal passed no longer understood its meaning, the weight of sacred tradition, hoary with age, would ensure that they continued to transmit it and would do their utmost to keep it free from interference. Secondly, the signal was hardwired into certain megalithic sites. Some were hidden in plain view, like the Giza complex, which successive cultures continued to work on and perfect for thousands of years according to the divine canon. Others were buried in the ground, time capsules like Göbekli Tepe and perhaps like that mysterious chamber deep beneath Gunung Padang, and primed for rediscovery when the time was right. There shall be memorials mighty of their handiworks upon the earth, the sacred sermon of Hermes tells us, leaving dim trace behind when cycles are renewed. According to G.R.S. Mead, the pioneer scholar in the field of Gnostic and Hermetic studies, these lines are meant to turn our attention back towards the past, to a time when a mighty race, devoted to growth in wisdom, lived on earth, and left great monuments of their wisdom in the work of their hands, dim traces of which were to be seen in the renewal of the times. Mead finds in this an echo of the ancient conviction that there were alternate periods of destruction by fire and water, and of renewal. In Egypt, the common belief was that the last destruction had been by water and flood. Before this flood, there had been a mighty race of Egyptians, the race of the first Hermes, some dim traces of the mighty works of this bygone, wisdom-loving civilization were still to be seen. And Mead adds, as few